Live from the Radio Catskill Studios in Liberty, New York, this is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, it feels like we're going backwards. That's how Sullivan Fresh cupboard staff describe the surge in food insecurity they're facing. Emergency calls for food and aid have doubled in just 3 months, but with federal cuts in demand at an all-time high, they've hit capacity. We ride along on a morning delivery to see how they're fighting to keep rural families fed amid an uncertain future. And another chance to go up close and personal at Woodstock. It's Woodstock Anniversary Week. We'll go along with an attendee of the original 1969 Woodstock Music and Arts Fair as she returns to tour the site after 56 years. Plus, artist Betty Blau on her new exhibit, From Where I Stand, and science stories with Joe Johnson, our resident science guy. That's coming up after the news from NPR.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Kristen Wright. The 48th Kennedy Center honorees will be announced this morning. President Trump is expected at the Kennedy Center. NPR's Elizabeth Blair reports the honors are considered prestigious lifetime achievement awards in the arts.
Traditionally, artistic excellence has been the main criterion for the awards. Past honorees include Steven Spielberg, Quincy Jones, and Rita Moreno. Honorees are usually living artists when they receive the award. Trump has floated the names Babe Ruth and Elvis Presley as possible recipients. Trump posted that, quote, tremendous work is being done to prepare for the honors. But the Kennedy Center staff was caught off guard by the announcement, according to a person familiar with the situation who spoke on the condition of anonymity for fear of professional repercussions. They're worried they won't have enough time to sell tickets and sponsorships. The Kennedy Center Honors has traditionally been the performing arts venue's biggest fundraiser. Elizabeth Blair, NPR News, Washington.
The White House is ordering a review of the Smithsonian Museums. In a statement, the Smithsonian says its work is grounded in a deep commitment to scholarly excellence, rigorous research, and the accurate factual representations of history. The State Department's annual human rights report is critical of the rights situation in three African countries where the U.S. is sending deportees, Eswatini, Rwanda, and South Sudan. Kate Bartlett reports from Johannesburg.
In Eswatini, where the U.S. last month sent five foreign nationals it described as criminals, the State Department noted concerns over, quote, unlawful killings and torture. In Rwanda, which is set to take in 250 migrants expelled from the U.S., the report found evidence of, quote, serious abuses in a conflict and arbitrary arrest and detention, saying impunity for officials was also a concern. In South Sudan, where the Trump administration deported eight men after a legal battle, the report found, quote, disappearances, trafficking in persons, and forced labor. For NPR News, I'm Kate Bartlett in Johannesburg.
Stocks open higher this morning, extending Tuesday's rally. NPR's Scott Horsley reports the Dow jumped about 367 points in early trading.
Both the S&P 500 index and the Nasdaq closed out the previous session at record highs. Despite a jump in core inflation last month, investors are betting the Federal Reserve will cut its benchmark interest rate in September. GE Appliances plans to build more refrigerators, stoves, and water heaters in the U.S. The company says it's shifting some production out of Mexico and China and investing more than $3 billion in domestic factories. The Treasury Department says it collected $28 billion in tariff revenue last month, a nearly fourfold increase from July of last year. The government's still running a big deficit, however, and this week the accumulated federal debt topped $37 trillion. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
This is NPR. A small town in rural Tennessee will soon be the site of a privately run ICE detention center. Mariana Bacayao from member station WPLN reports the town of Mason approved the contract at a tense meeting last night.
A 600-bed prison in the town of Mason has sat empty for nearly 4 years, but it will soon be filled with ICE detainees from across the Mid-South. In a contentious town hall meeting, the mayor stressed the economic opportunities for cash-strapped Mason. Resident Civil Miller Watkins said she doesn't see all money as good money.
This particular detention center would be less than 20 minutes from my son's high school. And when he graduates, this is not the job I want him to be able to have.
The detention center will be privately run by CoreCivic, a for-profit prison operator, which is under investigation by the DOJ. For NPR News, I'm Mariana Baca Yao in Nashville.
An emergency virtual summit on the Ukraine-Russia war is underway. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky is in Berlin with Germany's chancellor for in-person and virtual talks with European leaders and President Trump. A press conference from Berlin is expected this hour. Trump and Russian President Vladimir Putin are meeting for talks in Alaska this Friday. Trump has suggested the two countries may need to swap territories under the terms of a peace agreement. A Russian foreign ministry official today seemed to tamp down that idea. The White House is downplaying chances of a big breakthrough in Anchorage to end the war. I'm Kristen Wright, and this is NPR News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Eric and Wendy Schmidt through the Schmidt Family Foundation, working toward a healthy, resilient, secure world for all. On the web at theschmidt.org. This is NPR.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for joining us. Increased food and housing costs, along with federal funding cuts, are hitting home. Sullivan County's Cornell Cooperative Extension's Community Cupboard has said that emergency calls for food aid are up 100% in the last 3 months. The Community Cupboard currently delivers to about 700 people each week, including running a 7-day-a-week emergency delivery operation. But with food insecurity on the rise, federal USDA cuts, and proposed Medicaid and SNAP cuts looming, the organization has reached its capacity limit. Radio Catskill's Kimberly Izar joined the Sullivan Fresh Cupboard team, who provides sustainable food and service support to hyper-rural communities and food deserts, on their morning route to chat with the team about how they're navigating an uncertain future.
We're on Route 17 right now, heading to another part of Sullivan County, and I'm following the Sullivan Fresh van onto the next drop-off.
On Monday mornings, Shanice Owens and Lynn Calavito make more than 70 drop-offs of food across Sullivan County. They'll rotate who does what during their 4 to 6 hour route. While Shanice drives the Sullivan Fresh van, Lynn hand delivers a bag or box of food to a neighbor, or vice versa.
We are at our third delivery today, and Lynn is just bringing the box of food to the person's door.
Okay, and then where are you heading next?
We have one more apartment in this complex.
That's Shanice Owens. She's one of the Sullivan Fresh program coordinators. Within just a 2-mile stretch, she and Calavito make about 7 individual stops across 3 different apartment complexes on Monday morning. Their van is packed with dozens and dozens of bags and boxes of fresh meats, box pasta, milk cartons, and prepackaged meals like lentil soup.
Veggies, fruits, meat, dairy, depending on what we have.
Right.
We give what we can. We try to always make sure that there's always all the food groups.
Program coordinator Lynn Calavito says the Sullivan Fresh Cupboard started as a grassroots effort during the COVID pandemic in 2020.
Everybody was told not to go out. How are people supposed to get food? So Martin started, he had gotten some extra lunches from the Monticello Central School, and he would deliver those. So that's out of his car. So it kind of started there.
So it was very, like, informal.
Oh, yes.
Okay.
Yeah. And just trying to help each other out kind of thing.
The Cupboard delivered 365 consecutive days when they first started, even on holidays like Thanksgiving. Now it's quickly grown under the umbrella of Sullivan County's Cornell Cooperative Extension's Sullivan Fresh program. Before heading out for the day's route, Owens and Calavito individually pack each bag with an assortment of food and beverages.
I'm just going to give everybody, if I can, a couple of radishes.
They say they deliver to people across the county, to their neighbors in houses, apartment complexes, hotels and motels, cars and tents, from one end of the county to the other.
Folks in Monticello, Liberty, Fallsburg, Lac Sheldrake, Mountaindale, Woodridge, it's probably a few other towns, We deliver once a week too. We have pickups on Wednesdays, so we have some other areas like Swan Lake and Woodburn, just to name a couple, that will deliver twice a month. And then we have a Livingston Manor route once a month and seniors at various locations in Liberty and Monticello once a month.
But covered staff say that the need for food assistance is rapidly growing in Sullivan County, far beyond the team's capacity. At last Thursday's Sullivan County Government Services Committee meeting, CCE's Prevention Programs Issue Leader Martin Colavito said emergency calls to the cupboard are up 100% in the last 3 months.
Our commitment is that somebody who doesn't have food, we deliver food within 24 hours. We can't put them on our regular route, the 700 plus people a week, because of capacity issues. So I don't want to say it's doing, and a lot of the referrals, one of the things that's really worrying us now is that we're getting more and more referrals from folks who do reside in higher education or work for some of the agencies that this room kind of oversees.
Yeah.
We're getting more and more calls from these agencies now. So I don't want to put a damper on things, but it's just the reality of the situation, right? So the cupboard now currently is, I don't want to say doing well, but it's working, it's operating, it's meeting all of its objectives, and plus, my concern is moving forward, you know, being able to continue it, you know, next year, because of the increased capacity, increased need, and what's going on with resources.
The Sullivan Fresh Cupboard team say they deliver to approximately 700 people each week, making roughly 260 plus stops weekly. But more folks are in need, says Colavito. The program currently has a wait list for families and individuals waiting to get on their weekly route. Colavito told Radio Catskill that in past years the cupboard operated, he'd get 1 to 3 emergency calls a week. But now,
we're getting more than one a day now when you do the course of the week. We got 3 yesterday. We have 1 today. So we're getting them daily.
The sharp rise in food insecurity comes when food aid programs, food banks, and pantries are still navigating the impact of federal budget cuts.
Being at capacity is one thing. We have access to much less food, much less cost-free food from the regional food bank of the Hudson Valley. Over the past 3 or 4 months because of cuts to USDA and so on and so forth. So the stuff we used to get last year that was cost-free and covered by USDA, things like meat, eggs, fish, canned goods, now we have to pay for. And it's becoming harder and harder with this current situation funding-wise and what feels like a lack of consideration for those who are suffering in our communities. You know, my biggest fear are the people that we love the most, are the people we need the most, and those are the people who are suffering, because if we can stabilize them, we stabilize our communities. And it seems like, it feels like we're going backwards.
Lynn Colavito says the lack of transportation in the county and rising costs of housing have been major drivers for why residents need additional food aid. A new report from Pattern for Progress shows that the cost of housing in the Hudson Valley is rising faster than wages for renters and homebuyers. From 2024 to 2025, the average hourly wage of Sullivan County renters rose less than 1%, only 8 cents from $15.13 to $15.21 an hour. But the fair market rent for a 2-bedroom apartment in the county saw a substantial jump during that time period. Rent went up 13% from $1,078 to $1,223 a month. In July alone, the Sullivan Fresh Community Cupboard made more than 1,200 deliveries. They fed more than 600 seniors, 1,500 adults, and 700 plus kids in the month of July, according to data that the cupboard shared with Radio Catskill.
We're helping a lot of people, and we should feel good about that.
Yeah.
I want to go back to remembering that. And there's always, I realize you can't help everybody, but you just hate seeing people who need a little bit of help, and some need a lot of help. And we meet so many great people on the route that are just super great people, and they just need a little help. That's all.
The food deliveries have also been an opportunity for the cupboard team to connect with residents to other items they may need, like doTERRA packages to safely dispose of prescription medications or Narcan kits. With the current proposed Medicaid and SNAP cuts in Trump's recently signed Big Beautiful Bill, Lynn Colavito is worried about how many more people will need their support.
It just scares me that I keep hearing more and more people, they're not having enough resources to get their own food, just not making it through the month. I'm sure it's not everybody, but it's too many everybody's. And I'm just worried if people's SNAP benefits are reduced, besides who we're helping now, can we help more?
Martin Colavito says that local and state officials need to step up to see how urgent the issue is.
Now, then I will say this, and I probably shouldn't, but I think more of the people who are drawing paychecks politically need to get out into the community. Rather than look for headlines, they need to step out into the community. And not for my sake, but for the sake of the people that are employing them.
Sullivan Fresh's Community Cupboard is open for food pickup on Tuesdays and Fridays from 9 a.m. to 12 p.m. in Liberty. You can also find a complete list of food pantries and free meals in the county in the Sullivan 180 Community Guide at sullivan180.org. In Liberty, I'm Kimberly Izar for Radio Catskill.
And we'll take a break. And when we come back, 56 years after Woodstock, she came back. A new Bethel Woods tour takes an attendee of the 1969 Music and Arts Fair to places most visitors never see, and Radio Catskill was there. Hear the stories right where they happened next. This is Radio Catskill.
Hi, Ira Flatow here from Science Friday. We view Sci-Fry as a refreshing break from the daily bombardment of political news. You know, there's lots of important and interesting science and technology out there. Whether it's the deep, dark mysteries of the universe or your deep, dark microbiome, it's all right here. So start your weekends with thought-provoking news on Radio Catskill.
I'm Maria Hinojosa. This week on Latino USA, a conversation with Late Show with Stephen Colbert comedy writer Felipe Torres Medina about his new book.
For me, as a comedian, there is an element of having to face the horrors with humor because it's the only way we can endure it.
That's this week on Latino USA.
Thursday afternoon at 1 on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Catskill. I'm Tim Bruno. It's Woodstock Anniversary Week, and our coverage is continuing. Right now, we're stepping back onto the sacred ground of music history at the site of the 1969 Woodstock Music and Art Fair. This year, a brand new Main Gate Tour is opening up hidden corners of the site, giving original festival goers a rare chance to see places that most visitors never do. Earlier this month, Minna Traugott returned here for the first time in 56 years, walking those paths again with the Museum at Bethel Woods curator, Dr. Neil Hitch, and Radio Catskill's Jason Dole went along for the ride. So you'll get to hear every story and every memory as they unfold for Minna right where it all happened.
My name is Minna Traugott, and I'm here in Bethel Woods to see all the Woodstock Festival exhibits because I went to Woodstock. In August of 1969, I was 18 years old. I was between my freshman and sophomore year of college, and I was home, living at home in Berwyn, Pennsylvania. And I was working to save money for going back to school and had a number of friends from high school that we all hung out together, and we bought our tickets for $18 for 3 days. They all came to my house, and we all loaded in a Volkswagen Beetle, six of us, or seven, I'm not quite sure.
Minna Traugott is at Bethel Woods in early August 2025 with a small group including her husband and friends, and they're about to get on a six-seat golf cart for a full tour of the parts of the original Woodstock Festival site that most folks don't see at Bethel Woods. It's called the Main Gate Tour, and it's led by Neil Hitch, chief curator at Bethel Woods.
The Main Gate Tour is really new this year in 2025, and it's a tour focused on the planning of Woodstock. Literally, the question is, did you know there's a main gate at Woodstock? And everyone's like, no, I thought there was no fences and no one took tickets and it was a free concert. And you say, well, there's a main gate, right? Like, that's very planned. It's built. You can almost see pictures of it. And so this idea of how camping was planned and the free stage was planned and the free kitchen was planned and the main gate was planned and the Bendy Woods was planned. I mean, that's what this tour focuses on. And so by using this golf cart to get people out, we're really to be able to talk about or interpret some of these lesser known parts of the festival. For most people who attended, your experience was either this side of the stage, camping, eating, bathing, whatever, or the other side.
I think I was the other side.
You were the other side. So
that's why I didn't. Everybody says, well, everybody was nude at Woodstock, right? And I'm like, no. I didn't really see that. I saw it in the movie, and I'm sure there were, but no, it wasn't like rampant where I was.
No one sees all of Woodstock. Everyone saw the Woodstock that was right in front of them.
Yeah, I didn't.
What we say is Woodstock is not one story. It's 450,000 stories. Everyone has a very unique and very interesting story. And this is the historic field where the stage was.
Parking the golf cart at the top of the hill, Neil uses laminated photos of the site in 1969 to help Minna connect what she's seeing today to what she saw 56 years ago.
So this is the stage. Like, this is where we are. You can see this line here, that this is the Yasgur farm where everyone is.
I would say we were right about in here.
When you sat for the show.
Where we sat the whole time for the show. Oh. We were pretty high up on the hill, like right in here.
Cool.
I remember we wanted to sit on the crest as much as we could of the hill, but be able to move easily and not have to go through, you know, the whole crowd. Okay. It wasn't as much about being as in front of the stage or down by the stage as it was being able to hear everything really well. And we could hear everything really, really well. That sound was amazing that I remember.
What are you thinking? You sit up here and look down at this field now.
It looks smaller. I don't know, you know, I guess because it's not filled with people, but it looks like, oh, I thought it was further to the stage. I mean, it was massive amount of people.
It's a comment that everyone makes, that it just looks smaller than I remember. Your experience of seeing the site today as it is just so different than the overwhelming nature of the festival. And what a lot of people will talk about is just you weren't prepared, and every sense is just heightened. Everything is so much. Everything.
Mm-hmm.
The mud and the rain and the music and the people. It's not the same without that just sensory overload of what the festival was. I talked to someone about 2 weeks ago that was here, much like you, and their memory was you just went from, the middle up to a restroom, and it was 45 minutes, and you were constantly stepping on someone, that you couldn't walk through the crowd without stepping on people.
Which is one of the reasons we didn't go further down the hill, because it was more comfortable. And we could see and we could hear, but we could also get back and forth to wherever we wanted to go. So that was, I guess, a pretty good decision. We didn't have to step over too many people. We probably did, but I don't remember it being that difficult.
Now, Minna Traugott has clear memories of walking through the woods to get from the stage area to her campsite back in 1969. Well, this woodsy area is still there. It was known as the Bendy Bazaar, which had vendors and three different paths for folks to take.
I think it looked pretty much like this.
Does it feeling familiar to you?
Absolutely. Absolutely. It was very calm and peaceful. There were a lot of people on the path going in both directions. A lot of traffic. But it was fun. People watching, saying hi. You know, it was just a really happy, fun atmosphere. But there were a lot of people on the path most of the time.
We were just kind of out in the open in the sun and the heat, and now we're in this kind of green shaded world here. Yeah,
I think that was nice to get into this calm, you know, secluded kind of area.
But is your recollection kind of walking through this area to get to where your tent was?
Yes. I think so. We had to walk through woods to get to the tent. Now, whether it was on this exact path or not, I'm not sure. But I do remember going on this path to get to the bad trip tents.
So on one side of the Bindi Woods was the main stage and festival area for the Woodstock Festival, the part that most folks see when they come to Bethel Woods today. On the other side of these woods is an area that most people don't see. This is where many things were, including the main gate, a free stage, the Movement City, and the Hog Farm and the Hog Farm's freakout tent, which Minna remembers very clearly.
We stood in the entrance and looked in, and nobody came up to us immediately. They were all tending to people. And I remember just being like kind of overwhelmed at how calm. I mean, there's so much going on outside and the music and everything. But once just standing inside the entrance, it was incredibly calm. And incense was burning. I think there were, you know, music, sitar music, very soothing. Perfect environment for people that were in that state. And very calm, talked very softly. People came up to us and said, we don't know, you know, I think we did know his name. We said, this is so-and-so, and we don't really know him, but he was having a hard time, so we thought we'd bring him here. And they said, you did the right thing. We'll take good care of him. It was that simple. And it was I was really so grateful and so impressed that they were able to take care of them that way. And all the people, I mean, there were a lot of cots. There were a lot of people lying on cots. It was a pretty big tent. It was very calm and soothing.
I mean, one of the things we talk about this area today, again, in an interpretation of a historic event, is we call this the place where peace happened. You know, there's 9 months of planning. Peace wasn't an accident. Peace was the plan.
Well, it was evident. It was totally the atmosphere, but it really wasn't planned, because how could you plan for the number of people?
So again, what I say is there's 9 months of planning, and then you get overwhelmed by 450,000 people. The plan for toilets fails, the plan for food fails, the plan for rain fails, but the plan for peace succeeds. And the plan for peace created an environment where the mob mentality was peace.
Absolutely. There was a young man that just wasn't being very kind, and he was being kind of loud and obnoxious, and everybody was like, it's not cool. You know, man, just mellow out. It's okay. Not cool. And it worked, but everybody, they weren't like, get out of here, or, you know, threatening him or anything. It was just talking him down and saying, that's not how we want to be here.
Peace.
Yeah, peace.
Now, the last part of Minna's tour that I would like to share with you today is a moment that I think speaks to a lot of what this trip was about and trips like this are about, exploring memory to piece together what happened. And that's a big part of what the team at the Museum at Bethel Woods does to preserve the history of Woodstock and communicate what it means to the rest of us. They gather stories, gather facts, research the documents and the photos, and are able to piece together the story of what happened. Whether that's something as big and philosophical as planning for peace, or something as everyday as just dealing with the weather.
Do you know what days it actually rained, or when it actually rained?
No.
Because I don't remember it raining at all on Friday. We got here early Friday morning, slept on the field, and woke up to Richie Havens, because we'd been up all night, and we'd actually taken psilocybin. That's why we all fit in the Volkswagen Beetle so well. And everybody was partying. But then we fell asleep. We woke up. to Richie Havens. And I always thought it was him playing Here Comes the Sun, but that was my fantasy because he didn't play that in that set. I don't remember what it was, but I knew it was Richie Havens. And then we camped that night and, you know, saw next day John Sebastian, Country Joe, The Who, which was unbelievable. And I don't remember it raining.
So one of the things in how memories work in a way, right? This is how memories work. Very few people like have a memory of being wet or being hungry or being uncomfortable. Now, everyone was wet and everyone was hungry and everyone was uncomfortable.
I don't remember it real well. I think it rained Friday night because we got wet that night. And then the next day, the guys that were with us went and found those personal tents. Yeah. So we wanted to have a dry night the next night. I will say we left. We were burnt out and we decided as a group on Sunday morning, let's just go home. And we did, and we went back to our comfortable houses and had showers and all that. But, you know, I'm not sorry we left when we did. It was time for us to leave. I think, I don't know that we would have been able to enjoy the rest of it because we were just tired and whatever.
There's one is on Sunday. A lot of people leave on Sunday for that. Like, you have been up all night long and you've heard some of the best bands in the world. It's just this experience that is so exhausting. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people will leave. They have to go back to work. But Joe Cocker comes on at 1 o'clock, and at 2 o'clock on Sunday is the massive rainstorm. That's the one that's in the movie, and that people
at 2 o'clock on Sunday.
On Sunday afternoon.
Afternoon. Okay.
And so people that were caught in that also, then a lot of people just say that I'm done. Like that's and people that dodge it or that aren't here for that have a very different story. So if you left Sunday, your story is very different.
I don't remember torrential pain because I didn't experience them, I guess.
What was it like going back home after those 3 days? Do you remember what it was like immediately afterwards?
I do remember when I walked in the house and I was walking up the stairs from our garage basement, and my mom is in the kitchen and she sees me. I've never seen my mother more happy to see me than she did that day. I don't know what was out there in the news, but she was worried to death about all of us. She didn't know if I'd come home alive or something. That's, you know, and can you imagine it, with the press today, what the stories might have been told that would be totally untrue? And I think a little bit of that happened back then, even because, or it has been since, or it's been misconstrued, or people have been led to believe, because whatever picture they've gotten, it's just kind of, oh, that was just a big party, that was silly, everybody did drugs, you know, it was really stupid, blah blah blah. No, I don't think it was. This wouldn't be here today. People wouldn't be talking about Woodstock 56 years later if there wasn't something really phenomenal that happened there.
I want to thank you so much for coming back. I want to thank you for being so generous to take the time to talk to me. And it's such a gift to me and our listeners that you're able to share this with us.
Well, thank you, Jason. I'm honored, really, and I appreciate that all the work you guys are doing to keep this story alive and keep it truthful. That's very important. Thank you.
And our Woodstock Week coverage continues tomorrow with a look at the Vindy Bazaar. And we're celebrating all week, and you can find out about all of the activities at Bethel Woods Center this week, including the free programs, films, and alumni gatherings, and further exploration of the ongoing peace initiative at Bethel Woods. That's at bethelwoodcenter.org. We'll take a break, and when we come back, from tiny twists to cosmic hits, science that hits close to home with our science guy, Joe Johnson, you're listening to Radio Chatskill.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from the Narrowsburg Union and Catskills Curated, presenting products of regional artists, artisans, makers, and craftsmen. Gift wrapping and shipping available on site. NarrowsburgUnion.com. The Cooperage Project in Honesdale, dedicated to building community through performance, learning, markets, and good times. TheCooperageProject.org. And from listeners like you who donate at WJFFRadio.org.
In a crowded media landscape, public radio brings you something different.
Amafuri is a traditional Japanese folk song. It's about a child that is caught in the rain.
Human stories and epic tales.
The water was very cold. There were constant waves, and the wind blew for 10 days.
Help keep NPR and this station one of a kind by making your gift today. Thanks.
Make your donation at wjffradio.org.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. The Earth's rotation is subtly shifting. A meteorite just crashed through a Georgia roof, and flesh-eating flies are back in Mexico. How do milliseconds, space rocks, and tiny pests affect our world? It's time for Science Stories with Joe Johnson. Jason Dole caught up with Joe and the science stories that caught his eye this week.
Last week, we did a story on the varying radial rotation of the Earth and the change in day length. And we're only talking like less than 2 milliseconds here. We're not talking a big deal. And I misspoke, but let me get to this. Let me do the science first. So the radial rotation of the Earth has changed due to a number of factors: moon's position, storms, movement of liquid in the outer core. Any change in the position of a mass on or in the Earth can change the rotation. And I told Tim he should do the spinny chair experiment, where you spin around on a chair with your legs and arms out and then draw them in and you go a lot faster. And it kind of illustrates how a change in mass can change rotation. And the problem is that when I listened to the playback on it, when I heard it on Radio Chatskill, I cringed a little bit because I made a mistake. I used the term sidereal day when I was really talking about a solar day. And there's a difference between them. A sidereal day is the Earth's rotation as, determined by measuring the position of a distant star or radio source. And that's 23 hours, 56 minutes, and 4 seconds. A solar day is from local noon, when the sun hits the highest point in the southern sky, to the next solar noon. That's exactly 24 hours or 86,400 seconds. And I mixed up sidereal and solar day. And, you know, in science, we try to be precise about our language. And so, I did cringe a little when I heard the playback.
How I understand you're measuring it two different ways, but does that mean that we've got two different rotations? Like, how do we reconcile these two different things in our minds?
Well, it depends on how you measure it. Once again, if you're measuring from a distant star or radio source, 23 hours, 56 minutes, 4 seconds. But the Earth moves in its orbit about 1 degree per day. And so to get the sun back into that exact position, we have to then go another 56 seconds or something like that. And so it's the change of position of the Earth that causes the two measurements to be slightly different from each other.
Wow. So even though we are just talking about the rotation of the Earth, its orbit around the sun also plays into this.
Yes, absolutely.
All right. Well,
so, and like I said, I wanted to correct that.
Well, I'm sorry you had to make a correction, but I'm not sorry because I learned something.
Well, there you go.
So, and a new way of thinking about it, too. But now you've got a story about a meteorite. This isn't just a meteor. This is something that actually touched the Earth. And how?
Yeah. Well, a meteor is when it shoots through the sky. A meteorite is when it actually hits the surface, when it reaches the surface. And that's not that common because most of them do burn up. We have a meteor shower going on right now, the Perseid shower. A little hard to see because the moon is just past full. I did see one of the Perseids the other night, though. But this is a story that's been in the popular press about an incident from back on June 26th. In North Georgia near Atlanta, a large daytime fireball was seen and heard. It actually made a sonic boom going through the skies. And it was caught on a lot of dash cams and security cameras. And literally, there were hundreds of sightings of this fireball. The next day, it was reported that a meteorite fragment had actually struck a house in a little town called McDonough, Georgia, in a place called Henry County. And it actually made a hole the size of a golf ball in a residential roof. It was estimated to be moving about 1 kilometer per second. And that's about a little over 2,200 miles per hour when it hit this guy's roof. It went through the roof, went through a heating duct, through the ceiling, and made like a 2 or 3 inch wide crater in his living room floor. The homeowner said it sounded like a gunshot, like a loud gunshot. And, meteorites fall to Earth, but most of them are not seen by people because about 3/4 of them are going to fall in the ocean. And most of the time they actually do burn up before they hit the surface. Now, the pieces of the meteorite were recovered, and about a total of 50 grams were recovered. About 23 grams were donated to the University of Georgia Geology Department. The rest went to a local museum, by the way. And UGA released a press release, and that's where I'm drawing a lot of this information from, because I'm getting it from the source. They've studied this thing with both optical and electron microscopes, trying to figure out what it's made out of. And it came in as an L chondrite, a low metal content stony meteorite. It's probably from the asteroid belt between Mars and Jupiter. It's the most abundant type of meteorite, but here's the cool thing. It's actually older than the Earth. They figure it's about 20 million years older than the Earth. And I think that makes it pretty special. It's basically a leftover from the formation of the solar system. So it's going to tell us a lot about, you know, what the early solar system was like.
So is it something that could have been another planet but didn't make it? Or we just don't even know what bodies these things originally came from?
Well, it was a little fragment that didn't get incorporated into a planet. Like I said, it's a stony meteorite. So if it wasn't a planet, it would probably be in the crust somewhere, or at least the minerals would be. Speaking of minerals, it had olivine, pyroxene, and anorthite, probably as its three most common minerals. Those are commonly found in igneous rocks on Earth, so there's nothing like really exotic here. It did have a fusion crust on it where it actually melted as it came through the atmosphere. And by the way, this thing probably exploded, and there's probably multiple chunks of it all over North Georgia. It's just this one happened to hit somebody's house.
Yeah, I imagine folks are out there combing around to see what they can find out there. But if it's low metal content, that might make them even harder to find if there are other fragments.
Right. They actually look for meteorites with metal detectors out in the Midwest. They comb just giant fields with giant metal detectors looking for them. It's been called a McDonough meteorite because of the town where it hit. And that actually has to go through the nomenclature committee of the Meteoritic Society before its name is official. This is not unprecedented. Last year in Canada, there was a meteorite impact that was seen on dash cam, or I'm sorry, on somebody's doorbell cam. It actually hit their front walk. And in 1954, I didn't know this, I had to do some research, a woman in Alabama was taking a nap one afternoon when a meteorite came through her roof, bounced off a piece of furniture, and hit her in the hip and left a pretty good bruise. But that's the only time that I was able to find if somebody had been actually hit by a meteorite.
Wow, and thank goodness it hit several other things before it hit her.
Yeah, absolutely. Coming in that quickly.
Well, thanks for letting us know that. And now you have warned me, so I'll warn the listener. The next story might be a little touchy-feely, a little gruesome.
Yes, a little gruesome is a good word. I don't think I'd want to be eating breakfast while I listen to this. But this is about flesh-eating flies. This is a story I've actually been following for a while now, but the recent story in the New York Times made me think I should bring it to you folks. It's all about the New World screwworm fly. This is a pest that infects cattle and other animals by laying eggs in open wounds. You know, a cattle will scratch its leg or something going through a gate, and the eggs develop into larvae that then burrow into the animal. It could cause sickness, weight loss, and can even be fatal. The larvae actually look like wood screws. That's why they're called the screwworm fly. And they're not nice.
But wait, there's more.
Well, they've been controlled in the past. Uh-huh. Okay. These were at one point endemic throughout North and South America. They've been controlled using something called the sterile insect technique. They basically raise these flies in factories in the millions. And then when they turn into pupa, they feed them, you know, what they need to, a very high protein diet. And when they turn into pupa, they actually irradiate them with gamma rays. This sterilizes both the males and females. What they then do is they release when the males pupate, they separate the male from the female. They're actually, the pupa are different sizes, so they're easy to separate. They release the male adult flies out into the environment. They go out, mate with wild females, and of course then the union produces no offspring. And so this technique's been used in the U.S. for quite a while, since the 1950s. In 1966, they declared that they had eradicated the screwworm fly in the United States.
So why is it back?
Well, they don't know. What they had done was they had basically pushed this fly down the Central American highway there, or isthmus of land to South America, right to the border between Colombia, which is on the tip of South America, and Panama, which is just the beginning of Central America there. It was a place called the Darien Gap, and they created what they call a biological barrier, and they kept the fly south of there by weekly bombing this area with 10 million flies, 10 million sterile male flies, and it just kept any female flies trying to come through the area from reproducing. In 2022, this gap was breached. And once again, they don't know why. They think it could have been a shipment of cattle that was unregulated, that was uninspected. It could have been a weather pattern that blew a whole bunch of flies north of there. It could even be that the fly itself is adapting. So they're not quite sure what's going on here. But in 2022, the barrier was breached. In 2023, they were in Costa Rica. 2024, they were in Nicaragua and Honduras. And now they're in Mexico. Southern Mexico has had 2,700 cases. And kind of the most gruesome is they've had 25 human cases, too. And I don't think that's something I'd want to get involved with. The closest was only about 370 miles from the U.S. border.
So we see where that trend is going. Who is actually responding to this? Who's responsible for responding to this?
Well, the U.S. government has been working with the governments of Central and South America for years on this, funding this whole program. And in fact, there's a lot of cross-border cooperation going on right now because they're trying to beat them back. They're doing a couple of things. They're doing the fly drops. They're moving them up into Mexico. And they're called fly bombs. They drop them from planes in the tens of millions. So they're moving that up into Mexico. They're developing new baits and traps for them. New fly rearing factories are being built. Yes, factories to make flies, to raise flies in both Texas and Mexico. And they're really going to up the cattle inspection protocols to make sure that nothing gets shipped north that shouldn't be. Uruguay is even looking into gene editing to see if they can introduce a gene that would make them infertile.
Right. A new, different way of approaching this whole thing.
Yeah. Now, Texas has about more than a $15 billion cattle industry per year. So this is something that they're taking very seriously.
And don't mess with that.
Don't mess.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah. Well, Joe, thank you so much for bringing us all this science news.
Well, always a pleasure.
And thanks to Jason Dole for that Science Stories report with our resident science guy, Joe Johnson. We'll take a break. And next, artist Betty Blau takes us inside From Where I Stand, her new exhibit of layered collages built from vintage paper, nature's textures, and the stories hidden beneath. That's next on Radio Chatskill.
Next time on the Retro Cocktail Hour, we'll hear from Big Kahuna and the Copa Cat Pack. There's music for the original swinger and something new by the Enchanted Tiki Cats. Daryl Brogdon here. Join me where the music's always shaken, not stirred. The Retro Cocktail Hour. Coming up tonight at 7 on Radio Catskill.
Congress has approved a White House request to eliminate federal funding for public media. NPR and this station remain committed to informing the public, increasing your understanding of the world, and enriching everyday life. But without federal funding, we are relying on your support now more than ever. Please make your gift to this station today. Here's how, and thank you.
Give now at wjffradio.org.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Artist Betty Blau joins us today to talk about her new exhibit, From Where I Stand, a collection of richly layered collages made from vintage paper, nature's textures, and fragments of memory. In her Berryville studio, Betty transforms found materials into landscapes and charts that invite you to look closer and see what lies beneath. Good morning to you.
Good morning. Nice to be here.
So tell us a little bit more about From Where I Stand. What would inspire the title for this exhibit, and how does it relate to the themes that you explore in your work?
You know, I had many, many thoughts for the title of this show, and I landed on From Where I Stand for several reasons. The last 7 years, I've been met with lots of challenges, as many of us have, and I've come to really understand more than when I was younger, perspective and being aware of my perspective and the circumstances change and continue to change and realizing nothing is stagnant. And as a result, my perspective's constantly changing. So From Where I Stand is really about right now. From where I stand, this is where I am.
And your art incorporates, as I mentioned, vintage paper, ephemera. Mm-hmm. Can you share how you discover and select these materials and what draws you to specific pieces?
I love to flea market and estate sale and any, yeah. So I love to antique and I search for paper all the time. And I don't think I naturally started to search for paper. I think it was just something that came up. And my I've developed a large collection of ephemera. And when I say ephemera, I love plain paper. I love paper with writing. I love envelopes that have different colors inside. Some of my collages are completely made from old envelopes that you would never know are envelopes. And I also, like old paper, has ply. So mm-hmm. as you peel away the paper, things are left behind and you don't always know what's going to be there. And I love that kind of exploration.
From someone who also enjoys estate sales and flea marketing, I understand that like appeal of kind of going in and finding something that you relate to. I don't necessarily relate to the paper idea of it. And sometimes people overlook the paper.
Yeah.
But I will say that if I'm at an estate sale, I might be drawn to the desk because of the environment of like where someone may have written or yeah. the instruments they used or what's on that desk. Is that part of what draws you into the past experience maybe of the paper?
Absolutely. I love opening a book and seeing a name, a year, a drawing, some notes in the paper. People circle things. And I also love desks and I love bookshelves.
Bookshelves have a lot of good stuff.
They do. Even yearbook is just fantastic. An autograph book, a throwaway paperback might have the most beautiful front paper in it. Mm-hmm. And I just love that.
You describe your work as layered and worn, evoking language and memory. How do you approach building these layers? I guess, you know, in a conceptual way, but also physically.
Well, I start really by building, and I sometimes don't put my favorite pieces of paper at the bottom. I just kind of start to layer and layer, and I try not to get too attached with what I'm seeing. And a lot of times I'll paint a layer over that and then work with that and then start to see how the color of the paint is coming through the paper. And I just try not to get too attached, and I just try to build and start to see what I'm doing. I don't always know, most times I don't know the direction of my piece. Mm-hmm. I just kind of let it play out.
When I've spoken to other artists, they talk about how they are just working in the experience of whatever medium they are. And typically with painters, they're painting and with the brush. And you describe your work, but painting with objects.
Yes. I will say I do draw a lot. I use a lot of charcoal and I also use carbon paper quite a bit. When I describe painting with objects, I wasn't necessarily speaking about my collages. Mm-hmm. For years, I was a set decorator. And as a set decorator, I went from art school studying painting to being a stylist and a set decorator. It was kind of something I fell into, and I was naturally comfortable with it. And I think the way I justified my work and the way I was able to get through it, not that I didn't love it, I loved it, but it was almost like painting with objects. I did a lot of tabletops, so the bottle that I chose was very painterly to me, next to the textured surface, next to the napkin, and that to me was painting with objects. That's kind of how it manifested itself.
Your opening reception of this exhibit is Saturday between 4 and 7 at Hall Space with Nona Hall there in Eldred. And what do you hope people take away from Where I Stand? Are there any particular emotions or reflections you want to evoke?
I'm not sure I can say what emotions I want to evoke because looking at art is so personal. Just like the making of art is so personal. So I want people to interpret from their personal experiences. I do feel that there's a very calming element to the collages, and I like that, and I hope that they feel that. But I had a friend once who told me, don't ever title your work, because you want people to bring their experiences to it. I agree with that. I've titled many of these this time. Usually I don't. But I always think about that people come to it with their own personal take.
Do you have a favorite piece in the exhibit that you could share and some of the feelings or emotions behind that?
I do. I really am proud of this body of work, but there's one piece called Hoi An, which is a collage that I did when I was in Hoi An, Vietnam. And we were fortunate enough to be at an Airbnb on an edge of a World UNESCO Heritage Site that were organic herb gardens. And every day the gardeners, the citizens of Vietnam came out to care for their land. And there was a scent in the air that was sweet. And there was a calm over the entire thing. And I made that collage when I was there sitting outside. And that evoked a lot of beautiful memories for me. So that I would say is my favorite.
You have it up on your computer here in the studio. And from the distance here, it looks like a textile.
Yes, yeah, it does.
That's what I'm getting from.
Well, I appreciate that response. I like that.
It's also, you know, the directions and materials help guide you, I suppose. So can you see how your work might evolve from here, not really knowing where these materials you'll find next?
Yeah, I want to start to try to work larger. I'm rearranging my studio right now to hopefully accommodate that. And, you know, my last show, my work was much more graphic than this show. So I'm thinking the looser I get, the more I heal after the last 7-8 years. I hope that it just becomes more and more free and evoking calm and joy.
Is there a healing calmness to this exhibit for you too, Ben?
For sure.
That you found?
This has been a very healing year for me, much better, notwithstanding what's happening in the world. But personally, this has been a good run for me. So
that's it. Betty Blau, her exhibit is From Where I Stand. It's at Hall Space in Eldred, New York. It opens this Saturday. There's an opening reception at 4:00. And it runs through September 7th. There's more information about the exhibit at hallspaceny.com. And there's more information about Betty Blau and her work at bettyblau.com. That's BETTEBLAU.com. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you so much.
I'll look for you at the next estate sale. We'll meet at the desk.
I hope so. Thank you.
That's all for this edition of Radio Chatskill. A reminder, you can hear this program and all of our local programs and our podcasts at our website, wjffradio.org. There's lots to explore. And while you're there, it's your last chance to take our community survey. Tell us what you think is working well and what might need some improvement. And your voice now is more important than ever as we make some decisions moving forward. We're not going anywhere, but we just need your help to get there. Call us or go online, wjffradio.org, to give your feedback. This is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for listening.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from Dog Mountain Lodge, providing dog boarding and grooming, also boarding cats, birds, and other exotic pets. Located in Coshecton, New York, and on the web at dogmountainlodge.com. And from North American Cultural Laboratory, Highland Lake, New York, an experimental workspace for performing artists and inquisitive audiences, creating a space for community celebration throughout the year, nacl.org, and from listeners like you.
In the Chernobyl exclusion zone, the humans are gone, but lots of animals have made the area their home.
I remember a nest of a family of boar that had made residence in the front porch of one of these houses.
Ideas about what happens to abandoned places. That's next time on the TED Radio Hour from NPR.
Friday afternoon at 1 on Radio Catskill.
This week on This American Life, a man and his car.
You know, like some people also like use the pronoun it for the car. I use the pronoun she for her. Like, and people say you are in a relationship with this car. So.
In the small community where he lives, this guy Ali has the only car, making him the unofficial taxi driver, delivery guy, and school bus driver. So what happens when his car makes an enemy?
This American Life, Saturday night at 6 on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill, local news, culture, and NPR. Today's forecast, cooler than yesterday, partly cloudy this morning, thunderstorms becoming likely this afternoon, high 84. Overcast tonight at a low of 65. And tomorrow, partly cloudy with a stray shower or thunderstorm possible as well, and a high of 82. On Point is coming up next. You're listening to Radio Catskill.
WJFF Jeffersonville. From river to river, mountain to mountain, we are Radio Catskill.